And you thought we were going to get away from all this election nonsense. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Barry, there is no escape from election stuff.
That seems to be the case. I mean, we've bemoaned that for years now, that there's no break in the election cycles. That it just keeps going and going and going and going. Sort of like our program.
Well, actually, I've had people say, oh, I'm always sad when your program is over. Not very many.
I don't want to encourage that too much because you and I know how much time we have to spend getting ready to record and put together about an hour's worth of programming, and it's a little bit more involved than most people, I think, think.
I think so, yeah.
And you and I started out this, I think this was a good learning experience for us, Chuck,
yeah.
in the early days when we were doing not only this hour program that runs on Saturdays, but we were doing 15-minute dailies Monday through Friday. And honestly, those were tougher than this.
Yeah, they were. Getting something said in 15 minutes was tough. A. B, I was not recording properly. I'm going to be quite honest with you, ladies and gentlemen. Sometimes I'll tell Barry there's X number of seconds left, and he keeps talking. So at the end of it, it's good enough.
I'm a lobbyist. I get paid yes. to talk for a living,
so,
okay?
I would sit down for a 15-minute segment, and I'd have 17 or 18 minutes worth of stuff, and I'm like, okay, where do I cut? Well, there is a function that I can use on editing software called Time Stretch. But you can't stretch that much. You can stretch as much as 10%. So you can shrink too long or lengthen too short. So what you find yourself doing is sitting there, if you want to keep all the content, you sit there and you cut out all the pauses. Every time somebody says, or
you take a breath between words.
Now, if you cut it too much, it sounds like nobody ever takes a breath.
It's sort of like the guy who does the FedEx commercials.
The FedEx commercial guy, yeah. If you listen to the...
legal fine.
Any ad now that's for like financial stuff at the end, they go, this is not approved by blah, 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 such and such a state. You know, and it'll be like, well, I have actually cut one of those. Barry was a campaign manager for a race, I think for state rep or state senate, and I forget
senate.
Where.
State senate.
Yeah, that's right. And
yes.
I cut a couple of those, and what we did, we had to add those at the end. That's a requirement.
Right, a disclaimer, yeah.
So I had Barry, I said, talk as fast as you can. So he did the disclaimer as fast as he could without mistakes. And then I took it and compressed that time. So, I mean, it was just barely. Because that's the requirement. You have to say, paid for by blah, 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 for Senate, so-and-so chairman.
Treasurer. Yeah, treasurer
or chairman or whatever. And I shrunk that thing down. We were turning in ads, 30-second spots, 45-second spots, minute spots, and they were spot on. And the way I was doing it was like doing major editing.
Well, and you were doing a fantastic job, too, because not only was I recording the voiceover on those ads, I was actually the one who was buying and placing those ads with the studios. And a lot of the program directors were like, How much of this have you guys done? They're like, these are better than ones we get from some of the big companies. And they weren't saying quality-wise. They were just saying knowing their time restraints and hitting it spot on.
Well, I was getting it absolutely where it had to be. I said, if you bought a 30-second spot, that means you get 30 seconds, and it's going to start and end in 30 seconds. So I would cram them in there, and I can remember recording some of those. There was one, the race we're talking about. Oh, gosh, we recorded him recording his stuff. He would hesitate, and I go, can't hesitate. You got to get it out. You don't know how short 30 seconds is. And I said, y'all, believe it or not, you also don't know how long an hour is. Sometimes. It depends on the subject we get to. And occasionally, sometimes you and I will sit down and talk contemporaneously about an issue, and we look up, and I'm like, we're at a minute and four. We got to stop.
Yes, absolutely.
And we got way more to talk about. Other times, we're like, we can get stuff in, But if we go much over a minute or an hour and 4 minutes, it's really hard for me to cram that in. We have gone as long as an hour and 12 minutes. I can remember in the early days before I learned how to take you by the collar and shake you and say, stop. We had an hour and 12 minutes, and that took me hours to edit. I mean, literally hours. I can edit, if we go a minute and three, I can usually edit in about 45 minutes, depending on if I decide there's stuff that needs to come out, or if we've gone off on a tangent someplace and there's room. We had stuff recently where I'd made a statement and I wasn't happy with it, and I just went through and cut it out and connected the pieces. And can we do that? Yeah. If we did it live, we'd be in trouble. We'd be in trouble all the time. Because, you know, we say things, we tell jokes and things, and we just, I said, nobody's going to get that. I cut it out. It's a private joke between mm-hmm. you and me about this and that and another thing, and everybody, I'd say, duh, nobody's going to get that. That's inside baseball. You don't want to hear that. Some people do want to hear inside baseball, and we try to give it to you. Barry, you're very good at giving inside baseball, but your inside baseball stuff's on the legislature, which is stuff people really need to hear. You know, other stuff, our internal things about people we know and that kind of thing. Most people don't care about that.
No, because sometimes it can be fascinating to learn about, you know, what goes on behind the scenes of doing something like this program. And sometimes it's not. And, you know, we're not sitting here talking about this because we're trying to fill up time because we don't have anything else to talk about. It's just that we want to kind of give you that little peek behind the curtain to say, hey, these are some of the things we deal with, because it isn't all about sitting around and reading up on all the political blogs and websites and everything else and worrying and figuring out what's going on, although we do a lot of that too. But really, Chuck, I mean, this is really more about the fact that there's an awful lot that goes into doing anything like this. It doesn't look as easy as it sounds on the face of it. So I know sometimes I'll be sitting there listening to programs, and then I'll sit there like, wow, okay, now I really understand what they had to do to go to get that interview, to get it to sound like it did, you know, things of that nature, the music, etc., all that. Maybe it's just me. I'm a geek. So it's fascinating.
Well, look, there are times when we have recording level problems. We went through a period where I could not fit. There was a thing with, we use Skype to record this thing, in case you people haven't paid attention. We use Skype very often when we can't get face-to-face, which is about 95% of the time. So we use Skype. Well, Skype was kind of taking over our recording software, and it wouldn't let me adjust. It would self-adjust the recording levels. Well, that's no good.
I was going to say, no, that's a problem.
What will happen is Barry will say, one of us will say something very expressively and loudly, and all of a sudden the record level pops way down. Well, it doesn't pop way back up when you come way back in. So what you have to do is manually pump up the volume on the recording itself, rather than you pump it, you turn the record level back up on this end. But to make up for the stuff that the record level went way down, you have to pump it up manually. And if you're going through a, believe me, if you're going through an hour and 4 minutes of recording and hitting the spots and pumping up the volume in this spot, that spot, another spot, it's a pain. And it adds tons of time. So we've kind of solved that problem. I've gone back to another computer to record, and that seems to have fixed the problem. But we've chewed up almost 10 minutes out of our 60, and we're sitting here giving inside baseball on how we record stuff. I'd be quite honest, there's been a lot going on that we need to talk about. First of all, I want to give a report. As many people who listen to our show know, I'm on the board of Relationships Under Construction.
Yes.
That's relationshipsunderconstruction.com. And we had our monthly board meeting, but guess where we had it? I think I told you where we had
it. You told me, yes.
That's right. We had it at the Greater Columbus Right to Life banquet at the Villa Milano in Columbus. And it was a treat. They had an African speaker come in who had written, if you've probably heard of this, maybe if you're involved in pro-life action, who had written the open letter to Melinda Gates, if you know anything about that. That was kind of a big deal. There was an open letter to Melinda Gates written by this. And she is just a wonderful woman. She's from Nigeria and just a good speaker. They basically had to kind of broom her off stage. She was willing to go the whole night. And, of course, you know those banquets, Barry. They want mm-hmm. to get you in, get you the speech, get you the pitch, and get you to write a check. And get you home by 8:30, 9 o'clock. Well, they did a very good job. Beth Vanderkooy ran the show pretty well. But it was a wonderful experience, and we were very glad to help out with the Greater Columbus Right to Life in their efforts to end abortion in Columbus. And, you know, because of their efforts and many others, Mark Harrington of
Created Equal.
And many other groups have got Columbus down to 2 abortion clinics. And as far as they're concerned, headed to 0.
So, yes, well, that's what we're all trying to get to. So
good on them.
Yes, and I work, we work closely with Greater Columbus Right to Life, as they're a member organization of the Right to Life Action Coalition, which I rep for. And so, and we, you know, you and I have worked closely with Mark Harrington for years. So, you know, we're all, it's kind of like a whole big happy family. You know,
or sometimes not happy, but
keep happy families.
Yes, sometimes not happy, but we do our best to keep it in line. I was very, very pleased to do that. That being said, we have many, many, many things going on. We're recording early this week because I have a wedding in North Carolina. So I'm not available on Thursday or Friday to record.
Yes. So. But that's okay, because, Chuck, there's been an awful lot that's been going on already during this week, including, as I mentioned in our opening, election season. You know, just because the elections have come and gone, the primary elections have come and gone in Ohio because of the way our schedule works, that's not the case in many other places. And so what we've had is this week, actually yesterday, since we're recording this on Wednesday, on Tuesday, there were primary elections in South Carolina, Virginia, Maine, North Dakota, and Nevada. So 5 states had elections yesterday. And, well, Chuck, I mean, you know, you and I have been tracking this, and we've been talking about it a little bit here on the program. If there is going to be this massive tsunami of blue that's supposed to come and sweep away all the hopes and dreams and aspirations of the Republican Party in November, well, it certainly doesn't seem to be doing anything but ebbing right now. It's not a riptide, it's an ebb tide. That's the case. Because,
yeah.
and again, these are primaries, but there have been some other special elections, et cetera. And of course, they, you know, everybody, especially the Democrats for one and the anti-Trumpers for another, always focus on the Pennsylvania happening, you know, with the special election that to fill a seat that ended up going to a Democrat and it should have gone to the Republican. Well, not necessarily.
Yeah, not necessarily.
That's the problem that I have. I guess that's one of the fundamental baseline foundational problems I tend to continue to have with the Republican establishment. And that is this assumption that because something happened in the past that caused, in that district, I believe it was like Trump winning the presidential race by X number of points in that district, that supposedly automatically equates to them being able to put up anybody they feel like and win by that same type of margin in that district, as if voters don't have any real discernment between individuals. That as long as they're a Republican, we should win.
Yes.
And that right there is the Achilles heel of the establishment Republican Party, because there was a reason Trump won in some of these historically Democrat leaning districts or these marginal districts, and that was because people resonated with his message and with his vision and with the promises that he made, which, you know, we have to give credit where credit is due, that he's by and large keeping as president, which honestly is a breath of fresh air for many of us who have heard these kind of promises over and over and over again from politicians, especially those seeking the highest office of the land, only to find out that by the time their first 500 days in office has passed, and that's about where we are with Trump, that those campaign promises have basically been completely ignored or excused away as unattainable, and a new batch of promises that are slightly similar to the old batch of promises because they poll well, but are still as amorphous and unattainable as the ones that you've just basically have jettisoned and said we're not going to do in order to try to con voters into buying your brand once again, regardless of how it tastes, and continuing to, you know, give you what you want, which is the access to the lever of power because your party wins more seats than the other party does. But voters are not that stupid, Chuck.
No.
And honestly, it's an embarrassment to watch many of these, especially the Republican operatives, walk around like, Oh, well, it doesn't matter. As long as our generic ballot looks good, then we're going to be great. And then they get surprised when something like Pennsylvania congressional special election happens and a conservative Democrat wins. Because if you looked at their bona fides between those two, the Democrat was more conservative than the Republican.
Oh, yeah. It's happened many, many, many times.
Yeah, and it has. It's happened many times. Now, does that mean that he's going to govern that way or is he going to vote that way? Well, no, probably not, because there's an awful lot of pressure on these people, especially in the congressional level, when they get to those offices to back the caucus and back leadership. And we got to hold our vote off. And we saw that here at the State House last week. Not to segue too far, but we had a situation where we now have a Speaker of the House of Representatives again. It's Ryan Smith, my rep here from Gallia County. One. But he won not with a majority of votes, not with a majority of his own caucus, who hold 66 seats in the House. He only needed 50 votes in order to be the clear, unambiguous winner and speaker. He won with a plurality on the 11th vote, Chuck.
As you predicted.
Yeah, as I predicted, it took 3 hours. Also, as I predicted, everybody's asking me, I said, it'll be about 3 hours. They'll go to 11 votes. He'll win it. Bang, it happened. He basically came across with 44 votes.
That's not good.
Two of those were Democrats who are mad at their caucus leader, so they crossed party lines and voted for Smith. So he only got 42 Republican votes and 2 Democrat votes. But here was the deal. None of his votes moved. I mean, they just stayed right with him the whole time because they did the math. They understood it. If they just held tight, they had enough votes he had two other Republicans who put their nominations in the hat, Andy Thompson from Marietta and Jim Hughes from Columbus. And between the two of them, they kept shuffling their supporters back and forth between the votes to the point where it started out with Thompson having 17 votes and Hughes having 2 to ending up Hughes having 9 and Thompson having 10. But it was the same people flipping back and forth the whole time. So nothing really changed because they didn't siphon off any votes from Smith's coalition.
And the
Democrats voted as a block for the minority leader, Fred Strayhorn. Fred Strayhorn got 28 votes, and he got 28 votes, and he got 20, and he did that 11 times. Because the Democrats weren't going to give the Republicans a vote other than those two who basically are in rebellion against their own caucus and ran across and gave them to Smith. So what we have right now is going through the end of this year is we have a Republican caucus in the Ohio House that's split. You've got 19 members who wouldn't vote for Ryan Smith for any reason whatsoever.
Right.
Nobody left that coalition to come across to give Smith enough votes. Now, if you remember, Chuck, the key is that when you were voting, when you're on the floor, and like a bill, which actually has to have 50 votes in order to pass, it's a majority of the members present. So Smith only needed 46 votes to win because there were 7 members who were absent that day of the vote.
7.
And I don't mean they walked off the floor. They just weren't there for whatever reason, conferences, vacation time, because honestly, that session was scheduled, but nobody believed 2.5 months ago when this whole thing started, nobody believed that this session was going to happen. You know, that we weren't going to get to vote on a speaker again. And, of course, 4 Republicans, all whom were presumptively for Smith, weren't there. So he had 46 votes in the Republican caucus, and if they'd all shown up, he would have won on the first ballot because he would have won a majority of the members present. But he didn't, and he couldn't, and he couldn't get there, and nobody moved. And so now we have a new speaker who is now leading the rest of this session till the end of December with a split caucus.
Yeah.
And knowing full well that the Democrat caucus stayed in lockstep, mostly, 95%
yep.
lockstep, and not supporting him. So he comes in already with a chip against him, a couple of chips, because those 19 other Republicans can now get together with the 28 Democrats. And if you do the math, that's 47, and that's a lot more than 44.
Well, essentially, he's a lame duck with a split caucus. He's not going anyplace.
No. I mean, they may get a few things
done and
pass some votes back and forth, but that's going to be about it.
No more powering. There will be no powering through legislation that essentially embarrasses half the caucus.
No, probably not, because he's got a big enough block in his caucus who will stand up and squawk about it that they can't get 50. Then unless they go and make deals with Democrats who have shown that they don't want a deal, they can't get to 50 votes on some of these things. And so perhaps in one sense, gridlock is good.
Yeah, well, it's always good because controversial bills are going nowhere in this session.
Right. One just did, and that was the payday lending reforms, who, depending on who you ask, is either the greatest thing since sliced bread or it's just another stupid thing that's being done that is going to get ignored, and we're going to be back again in a few years moaning about how there were loopholes found and people are still getting raked across the coals for annual percentage rates of over 500% on a short-term loan. And, of course, one wag, and I'm just going to segue here a little bit, one wag, who's a lobbyist, I believe, for the payday lenders, actually did said, okay, listen, if we're going to talk about APR, then let's talk about the APR on, let's say that you're the average citizen and your account gets a little short and you bounce a check. And, you know, let's say you bounce a check for $3 or $4. He said the fee that the bank charges you is an annual percentage rate of like 1,247% if you extend it out like that.
Well, that is an apples and oranges comparison. That it's not an interest, it's a fee.
There really is
a difference. If you go in, listen, I know if I write a rubber check by accident, first of all, I have overdraft protection in case I do that, which happens occasionally because you'll write a check and people don't cash it for like 2 months. And you think it's cash, and you're like,
you spend the money again.
You spend the money again.
Like sitting there like, wait a minute.
But I know full well that there's a fee involved.
Oh, yeah.
It's not non-disclosed. I know full well if they bounce a check, it's going to cost me money. Not only that, it's going to cost me money twice because the other person, they get charged on their end. If you know how business works, if you cash a rubber check, you get charged too. I think it costs me $12 if somebody writes me a bad check. So I normally, if something has happened, it's happened occasionally from time to time. I think I got more money in the bank than I do because I haven't balanced correctly. I'll write them a check plus for their fee. And some companies will charge you. They say, you write us a bad check, we charge you $25.
Yeah, some companies will.
Yeah, so you get it on both ends. You get to pay the fee on your end, and then you get to pay the other guy's fee because they got it too. A lot of people don't know that. If your friend as an individual writes you a rubber check, all it does is bounce, okay?
Yep.
But as a business, the business pays if somebody writes my company pays if somebody writes my company a bad check. Bingo. That's just the way it is. It's how banks stay in business these days, fees.
Yep.
Do we need to fix the whole payday thing? Yeah, this thing, title loans and that kind of stuff, that's a scary thing. I can't imagine putting my house, my car up as a total guarantee for a short-term loan. No chance, because the potential for fraud there is so incredible. You take out a $300 loan and suddenly somebody has your house.
Yeah.
Which could happen. I want to go back for a sec. You know, you talked about liberals running as conservatives. This guy's never been particularly liberal, but very near you is a guy running, getting ready to, he's thinking about his next Senate run, and that's Joe Manchin.
Because his next Senate run is this year.
Yeah. So, and he's thinking hard about it because he sees the wave, and he definitely wants to get on the Trump bandwagon. He's a Democrat, folks.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk for a minute. I saw a thing today. To see the desperation that the press is trying to do to keep the quote-unquote blue wave alive, which I think I quipped the other day that it was actually turning into a blue drain.
Yeah, and it is.
And it is. Maybe it isn't a tide, and you said the word, it's a blue ebb tide. What they're trying to do to keep this meme alive is reporting on meaningless races, essentially, in the big scheme of things, meaningless. The big thing on Yahoo this morning, the big tout was the fact that a longtime Senate Republican who was supposedly a conservative lost the seat was lost. It's always been Republican for a long time. They lost to a Democrat, this seat. By a short margin. And, like, so what? It was a special election to fill a seat that will be vacated in January of next year.
Right. Well, and the thing is, you know, across the field, there's an awful lot of things happening. And, of course, you know, the naysayers, and by that I mean the never-Trumpers, are going to be moaning and groaning because, you know, you had a situation. Like I said, there were five states that had primaries. Well, the big upsets, the biggest one was in South Carolina, where incumbent U.S. Senator and former governor, or excuse me, he's a rep, not a senator. That's right. He didn't get to the Senate. He's a rep. Mark Sanford. And if people remember that name, it's because Sanford was governor of South Carolina. And he's, well, shall we say, infamous for making the phrase hiking the Appalachian Trail mean something other than hiking the Appalachian Trail.
I didn't know the Appalachian Trail went to Argentina.
Yeah, Buenos Aires, Argentina seems to be the termination point of the Appalachian Trail. And when you get there, I guess there's a reward calls a female Argentinian journalist whom married Governor Mark Sanford was having an affair with. And at the time, his press people were telling reporters that he was out hiking the Appalachian Trail and couldn't be reached for comment. He was actually in Buenos Aires, Argentina, committing infidelity against his wife with this female journalist. So he lost his, you know, seat as governor all over and was disgraced, but not disgraced to the point where they didn't use proxy machines and political propaganda and basically smoke and mirrors to get him back in as a federal congressman in South Carolina. But he did the one thing, Chuck, that's, I think, now pretty much unforgivable in this new political climate, is that he committed adultery against his own president. Mark Sanford was a never-Trumper, and he was vocal about it, and he was vitriolic about it, and it bit him, and bit him hard. It was like he got hit with a timber rattler on that Appalachian Trail. And that timber rattler's name was a primary opponent by the name of Katie Arrington. Katie Arrington won the South Carolina Republican primary last night against Mark Sanford because President Donald Trump personally endorsed Arrington, and the voters in that rep district in South Carolina had voted for Trump overwhelmingly. So Sanford obviously showed an incredible lack of judgment in his personal affairs with his wife, and by having his staff lie to cover up his infidelity. Well, the voters of South Carolina, like I said, Chuck, the Republican establishment thinks that the voters are ignorant, and they basically will just buy whatever they're selling. They didn't buy it this time.
I have to laugh. Katie Arrington, one of the campaign lines that she used, and this is too good, she called Sanford the Jeff Flake of the Congress.
Actually, you'd have to be a political insider to get that joke, right, but it's a pretty good one.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Jeff Flake is the other outgoing senator from Arizona, who is militantly anti-Trump, and not just anti-Trump. He is an open globalist. He is an openly and unabashedly an establishment guy. Won his seat, by the way, by running as an anti-establishment person,
mm-hmm.
and maintained that facade for part of his tenure, and then apparently got drank from the Potomac. That's what we call drinking from the Potomac. You suddenly become 100% establishment. You take all the money, you take all the perks, and suddenly you go from a true independent thinking, essentially non-conformist, to 100% conforming with the party line in the House or the Senate. So Jeff Flake definitely drank from the, and Mark Sanford as well. Mark Sanford mm-hmm. showed his true colors when he abandoned his wife and children for this Argentinian, this Latin lover down there.
Right.
And that's what he did. I mean, Mark Sanford's wife was out actively campaigning against him when he ran for Congress the first time.
Yes.
And unfortunately, how did the press paint her? As a woman scorned. Well, of course she was scorned.
Of course, she
was abandoned by her husband, who used her as a prop in his campaigns. Which is exactly what he did. He used his wife and family as props in his campaign.
Mm-hmm, absolutely did. And, you know, and when it got to, funny thing is, in this campaign, when you were looking at Sanford, he didn't have a South American beauty on his arm. I guess that maybe that little thing didn't last as long as he thought it was going to.
Well,
needless to say, just desserts, because South Carolina is one of those states, Chuck, that if somebody doesn't win decisively, i.e. with a majority, it goes to a runoff of the top two vote getters.
Yep.
Katie Arrington won so decisively, there will be no runoff in the South Carolina first congressional district. Mark Sanford got thumped and got thumped terminally.
Over 52% of the vote, and I don't know how many candidates were running in that district. I've been looking to try to find that out, and I can't find it.
I don't know if there were more than two, to be quite honest with you. I think it was a head-to-head.
Well, somebody would have ended up with 50% plus one then, either way. Because the way they made it sound, a quote-unquote runoff was avoided.
Right, which means there could have been more than, you're right, there's probably more than two. You're right, with a runoff, so.
You know, when I see that kind of language, that means there was a chance that there could, you know, apparently Sanford wasn't smart enough to run a shill to steal votes. Or he couldn't get anybody. He may have created a situation where they're like, no, we're not going to help you out. I'm reading something in a South Carolina paper that basically says that Katie was within striking distance. Yeah, apparently.
She was in such a striking distance that she struck and won.
She struck, yeah.
Yeah, she did strike. That's right.
So, that being said, it doesn't matter. Basically, Mark Sanford, who is a longtime political operative. Now, Katie Arrington has served, I think, in the South Carolina State Senate since at least a couple years. I think she's been in since 2016. That's quite a step up. You think about it, going to Congress. Now, we've had people that went from the state. Jim Jordan went from the state legislature to Congress, and so have others. It happens all the time. It's a step up. If you're unfortunately, you see a lot of these guys maneuvering when you deal with them. You can look at them and say, oh, he thinks he's going to the Senate, or he thinks he's going to the House.
Yeah, that's usually the case. Now, we've got some other states that, you know, we're having their primaries as well. And, of course, across the board, it looked like pro-Trump Republicans won their primaries in many of these states, for governor, for other places. But it's Nevada that's interesting.
Nevada's interesting, yeah.
Nevada is a very – I mean, if you think about it, there is much in the way of kind of a – Trump style, I guess, if you want to put it this way, theme going on out there in Nevada. And I guess in the Nevada state legislature, they now have a candidate who comes with probably the most PR of any candidate coming out of Nevada. Ever, probably. I mean, this guy probably is more familiar to Nevada voters than Harry Reid. Wouldn't you say?
Very possibly.
Now, he may not be familiar to most of everybody else in America, and probably not to most of our listeners, but to people in Nevada, this Republican candidate who just won his primary last night at the chagrin of the Nevada Republican Party is probably one of the more famous people on the face of the planet, especially from Nevada. The gentleman's name is Dennis Hoff, H-O-F. And if you think that name sounds vaguely familiar, you might have a subscription to HBO. Because Dennis Hoff has been in the news a lot over the years, Chuck.
Yes, a lot.
I mean, in mainstream news. And he also had a show on HBO. I'm not going to say what the name of the show was because it's a little salacious. So, because of Dennis Hoff's chosen profession. Dennis Hoff is the owner and operator of, I think, at least four legalized brothels in Nevada. Yep, that Dennis Hoff owns, and the one that's been, was made famous by a couple of movies, I forget, like Cannonball Run or something, is the Moonlight Bunny Ranch in Pahrump, Nevada, I believe is where it is.
Pahrump, yep.
Yeah, it's basically, it's a legalized house of ill repute. Because in Nevada, with their libertarian leaning, prostitution is legal. And keeping a brothel is legal. And Dennis Hoff has made a fairly comfortable living out of running these facilities.
Okay. And he also owns the Love Ranch, where Lamar Odom essentially almost came to an ignominious end.
Lamar Odom, who was a basketball player.
A former basketball player, right. who was married to one of the Kardashians, and another man destroyed by the Kardashians.
Yeah, there's that too.
Yeah.
But so Hoff won his primary last night in Nevada to take a seat in the Nevada House of Representatives at the state level. And the Republican Party in Nevada is not exactly, you know, big fan of that idea because of the negative PR. And of course, Chuck, as you said, if Dennis Hoff had been registered as a Democrat, the headlines in the papers across the country would have read something like successful Nevada business owner wins Republican primary.
Yeah, exactly.
But what did it say?
What was the
headline?
I quip that had he been a Democrat, he would have been noted as a courageous provider of working places for displaced sex workers.
Yeah.
But instead, if he'd been a Democrat, but he's a Republican, so it says Dennis Hoff, Nevada's most famous pimp, wins GOP primary.
Now, you know, from my perspective, Chuck, that headline is probably more accurate.
It's
than
accurate,
the other one
yes.
Would have been.
It's completely
it's probably
accurate.
Much more accurate than the other one would have been.
He's a pimp.
But
yeah.
But you know, but this is the situation where, you know, a lot of strange things can happen. And but you're right. I saw that headline and I had to laugh because, you know, and this was coming from the Las Vegas Sun. So, you know, not necessarily a paper that's not libertarian in its own respect.
No.
but because Dennis Hoff is a Republican, I mean, it was for a left-leaning newspaper to basically tie the words GOP and pimp together. They couldn't resist.
Well, look, Nevada's,
could not resist.
Nevada's election thing is very much different than we can think about out here. How did Harry Reid continue to win and win and win and win in what amounts to a libertarian or far more conservative state? Well, the way he won and won and won and won was by capturing what? The union vote in the state's by far most populous city, which is Las Vegas.
Las Vegas, of course, yes.
So, Harry Reid essentially had the union vote in Las Vegas, which is gigantic. And he managed to whip everybody into line, and they just he was losing margin on every 6 years, but he wasn't losing it fast enough to actually have a Republican take that seat.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is that Harry Reid won by capturing a block of votes. You can't do that necessarily in other states. You have to capture several blocks of votes.
Yep, you do. But not in Nevada. Now, it's very interesting, Chuck, because if you read, and we'll post this up on our site, is the Las Vegas Sun article about this primary, the way they're handling the angle of the story is that Hoff ran for this seat because the current occupant of the seat, who he beat, This doctor by the name of Oscarson was behind a ballot measure that is going to be on the November ballot about closing down some of these sex businesses, at least in one of the counties and where they're operating legally. Now, basically, it says that it's going to be in Lyon County. Hoff owns four brothels in that county. And activists are trying to get signatures to get the measure on the ballot in Nye County, where he owns two more. So, in other words, it looks like, and the reason why is because he ran against Oscarson 2 years ago as a libertarian, and Oscarson won. So then he gets into office.
Yeah.
Now, Hoff believes that Oscarson and his money are behind the signature gathering effort in order to put a referendum up in the two counties where he happens to own his businesses to get his businesses shut down and thus dry up his money. So this is all, you know, they say that, you know, there's nothing dirtier than you know, legalized prostitution. Well, politics is dirtier than that, because this is really what it gets down to. It's dirty politics. So Hoff jumped back in and he won. And I'm assuming that probably his win signals possibly a referendum on these two ballot, this ballot measure and the other one that they're trying to get on the ballot in the other county. I don't have the breakdowns yet, but if Hoff won by significant margins in either one of those two counties or both, that probably spells, you know, doom for the ballot measures.
I was going to say, the ballot measures, what you'll find is that Western voters are pretty savvy about when they're being manipulated. This essentially looks like a manipulation to strip Hoff of his all his capital as well as his political capital. And it's probably not going to work. I think you'll find that a majority of the counties involved, most people have never been to the Bunny Ranch or the Love Ranch or any of those things. Nonetheless, they have a very libertarian streak, and they'll say, you're not going to shut it down. It's providing jobs and revenue to the county. Therefore, they're not going to shut it down. Which is a very libertarian stance, and Westerners are at their core very libertarian.
Yes, they are. So Hoff now wins, but it was funny because in the article he quotes, and it's the reason why I said that, you know, this is kind of a Trump-esque kind of thing, is that Hoff has dubbed himself the Trump of Parump.
Yeah, the Trump of Parump. Yeah.
Yeah, and. So basically, and he says, and the AP, he gave a quote to the Associated Press. He says, it's all because Donald Trump was the Christopher Columbus for me. He found the way, and I jumped on it. So he's crediting Donald Trump with his win. Now, I do not believe that Donald Trump ever made any mention of any kind of support or didn't endorse or anything else Dennis Hoff's run for state legislature. But Hoff is basically creating this new mythos that he is like the Nevada version of Donald Trump. And so there you have it. Politics are a little crazy these days. Now, coming closer to home, Chuck, and, you know, folks, I want to apologize. I know we talked, we were going to dive more into the ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court regarding the Masterpiece Cake Shop, but we're going to save that for next time because this kind of all, you know, we try to be timely and topical.
Yeah.
And the timeliness was, there's an awful lot of election stuff going on right now. And one of the biggest things is also just at the end of last week, that same U.S. Supreme Court, in a more narrow 5-4 ruling, basically validated Ohio's, and this was a lawsuit coming up from Ohio, Ohio's method of purging voter rolls of people who don't vote. Now, we've had a history of basically scrubbing the voter rolls, and you take a look at it, and if people's registrations have lapsed or they haven't voted in X number of consecutive elections, the Secretary of State's office, and, you know, John Houston's been doing this now, but I do believe that this started, it started with him. I mean, he started doing this. Of course, all Secretary of States are supposed to be doing this on a regular basis. But many progressive leftist activists think that that's disenfranchising voters. You know, those people that when you find voter rolls where somebody hasn't voted for years, you create a fake ID and you send somebody else in to vote in their place so that you can build you can pack votes. Yes, it does happen, folks. Let's not kid ourselves. And it doesn't just happen on one side. It happens on both sides. Let's not kid ourselves about that either. But the Supreme Court basically said that, yes, you can, the state system for removing voters from the rolls is constitutional. And what they do is, after so many elections where the voter doesn't vote, they contact the voter or try to, they seek to contact the voter by sending notices to the last registered address, etc., certified mail, the whole thing. I mean, they take a lot of steps. It isn't just they go in and say, I don't want that person voting or that person voting. There's a process, and it's a process that's got a lot of eyes on it. And the Supreme Court said, against the challenge that it was unconstitutional and it was somehow disenfranchising voters, that that's not the case. So, looks like our ballot integrity and elections process are going to be just fine for the fall election. Right, Chuck? Wrong.
Wrong.
Because on Tuesday, now remember, this case came out like on Friday. They basically stated, you know, Ohio's, they gave the ruling to the state, so the state won, so the state can basically go ahead and continue using the scrubbing process, as it's called, to clear the rolls so that they know that we have ballot integrity and that people who are voting are actually registered voters and not, you know, people whose identities are being falsified because the original person has died, but their voter registration is still on file with the Secretary of State's office. However, Secretary of State John Husted, who's also running for lieutenant governor with Mike DeWine in the Republican, you know, for Republican side of the ticket against the Rich Cordray, Betty Sutton Democrat side of the ticket for governor this fall, made an announcement on Tuesday and sent it to the county boards of elections to tell them they cannot resume the process of scrubbing voter rolls until after this November's
election. Oh, of course.
Now, when that came out yesterday, I have a number of political types who are, you know, are on my Facebook feed and friends of mine and various say people were incensed, absolutely incensed, you know, that here's Husted grabbing defeat from the jaws of victory. And, okay, that's what it looks like, right? Here is basically the Ohio Secretary of State's rationale for doing this. And this came from the Assistant Secretary of State, Matt Damschroeder, who sent it out to the County Board of Elections, and it says, quote, "You are hereby advised to take no action until further notice regarding Ohio's supplemental process that has been on hold since this litigation began in 2016. So we haven't been scrubbing any of these rolls since they started filing a lawsuit, the progressive leftists did, in 2016. And then he goes on. Once additional information and instructions are available, we will provide it to you. And it says that he added, quote, "It is important to remember that even though the court clearly said Ohio's longstanding supplemental list maintenance process did not conflict with the National Voter Registration Act, which is a federal law, the other requirements of the NVRA prohibit list maintenance cancellations prior to this November's general election," unquote. So basically what they're saying is, although the Supreme Court said that what we're doing is constitutional, there are provisions of a federal voting act. And Chuck, think about when was the National Voting Rights Act passed, Registration Act passed?
You're talking...
under which administration?
A motor voter? Bill Clinton, 1993 or 1994.
Right. See, there's a little provision in the NVRA that basically says that it prohibits canceling voter registrations less than 90 days prior to a federal election. Right? So, okay. Okay, it's what now? June the 14th?
It's June November the 13th, yeah.
November the 6th. Gee, by my calculations, that's a little bit more than 90 days, right?
Way more.
Ah, but now you can thank Pat Tiberi for messing up a good thing. Because we now have a special federal election on August the 7th to fill his seat when he decided he's going to step down and take the money and become the president of the Ohio Business Roundtable. Remember? He left in January, end of December, beginning of January, and there was a primary for the seat, and it was a 10-way primary, and Troy Balderson supposedly won that seat,
although
the second-place finisher in that primary, Melanie Linehan from Delaware County, has contested and is paying for a recount of ballots in specifically in Muskingum County in Troy's home district, where he won over 80% of the vote, Chuck. Yeah, thank you. Exactly. Okay. Yeah, he's the hometown favorite, right?
Sure.
But it's a 10-way primary.
Yeah.
Do you really believe that over 80% of the ballots cast in that one county is going to go to one candidate?
No.
When you've got 10 choices to choose from? No, it doesn't make logical sense. Now, okay, so Pat threw that in. But the special election to fill the seat for the general is August the 7th, which, if you start doing the numbers, is inside 90 days from June the whatever date the Supreme Court ruled, which was last, like, the 9th.
Okay, this is odd, and I'll tell you why. Because when we voted, that's my district.
Yes.
When we voted, we had to vote for a candidate twice.
Yes, you had to vote for the special election to fill the seat for the end of the year, to pick a nominee to fill the seat
exactly.
At the end of the year to run in the special general. And then you had to vote for a candidate to actually be the nominee to run in November to take the next term that starts next January.
Okay. My understanding was that we were having the special to fill the seat.
For the end of the year, because the term has not ended.
Right.
Pat Tiberi's term had not ended. And so, therefore, his term extends until December 31st of this year. So, the first vote was a special primary to pick a nominee to run in a special general, which is now August the 7th.
Right. Oh, okay.
And the winner of that special primary, once certified, will then immediately go to D.C. to take a seat in Congress through the end of the year. And then the other vote in the primary was to pick
the
nominee
fall candidate.
Run in the November general election against someone to be seated in January in the next Congress.
Now, see, I thought Tiberi had already here's what I get for reading the Newark Aggravate. yeah, folks, if you think you get decent information out of a newspaper, well...
Not so much.
No, I honestly, I remember, I'm supposed to be up on this stuff. I'm not. I thought Tiberi had already resigned.
He did.
Well, I mean, effective
on the day he resigned, which I believe was sometime in like December or January.
Yeah.
So that seat, you have not had congressional representation now for 6 months.
And see, I thought that's what we were doing was filling that seat.
You are, but because it's a contested seat, it isn't the whoever wins that primary immediately takes a seat. It's whoever wins that primary goes on to run in a special general to fill the seat.
Okay.
Which means that many people will have to go to the polls in August. And most of them won't know, except maybe like grassroots activists, Democrats.
Yeah, exactly.
That there is a summertime federal election that whoever wins it, whether it's a guy by the name of, I think, Denny O'Neill, who is the Democrat nominee, who's the Franklin County auditor, I believe, or treasurer.
One of those, yeah.
One of the two versus, well, right now it's Troy Balderson, who's the state senator from Muskingum County. But, again, as I mentioned, Linehan has asked for a recount, is paying for out of her finances and out of her own pocket, I think, a recount, especially of ballots in Muskingum County. There's been a wrinkle that's happened. Okay? And I know this because I know people inside their camp. The recount of those ballots in those wards and precincts that they picked was scheduled for last Wednesday. Okay?
Uh-huh.
There would be representatives coming from Linehan's campaign and from Balderson's campaign, and probably maybe from one of the third place finisher if they decided to get into it. Now remember, Linehan's paying for this. It's like, I forget how much it is, but it's like so much, like $60 per precinct, and there are 80 some precincts in Muskingum County. So I mean, it's not a small chunk of change to get a recount.
$5,000, yeah.
Yeah, it's like $5,000. So she's paying for this because she lost by less than 700 votes district-wide. And having one county come in where one candidate wins 80-plus percent of the vote looked a little odd.
It's a Chicago-esque.
Well, it gets more Chicago-esque, Chuck, because when her representatives, her attorney, and everybody else gets there, they wheel the ballots into the room, the ballot boxes into the room. They had already been unsealed.
Oh, no.
Which is a violation of state law, because they are not supposed to be unsealed until they're in front of all of the witnesses, especially the witnesses for the candidate who requested and is paying for the recount.
Yeah. Wow.
But because and I believe that their camp is looking to file a lawsuit against this, against the Muskingum County Board of Elections, because they violated the law. Now, it's a felony offense, Chuck, to do this. And the County Board of Elections officials admitted they did it. Yeah, we opened them on Monday.
Wow.
So the question is, and what they found out since then by talking with some elections attorneys is that Ohio passed a little law back in like 2006 when John Husted was the Speaker of the House of Representatives, and it was a Republican measure,
and is now the Secretary of State,
that basically said that the state cannot interfere in anything in a federal election. Because normally what you would do with a question of a county board of elections violating the law is take it to the Ohio Supreme Court and they get an immediate ruling. It looks like you can't do that because it's a federal election and it's under this provision. So you have to go through and try to file a case up at either the district or circuit court or maybe the U.S. Supreme Court, which isn't cheap, in order to find to and the question is, If a suit is filed, which I think they're going to file, and it is found that the County Board of Elections corrupted the integrity of the vote because of violating this provision and opening these sealed containers of raw ballots in a illegal manner, then the question remains, what does that do to the issue of who stands for the special election in August?
Yep.
And also who stands in November?
Yep. Oh, this is a mess.
This is going to be a bigger mess. But the point is that if you were just looking at it on the face of it, it's starting to look fishier and fishier.
Fishier and fishier. It looks like Chicago.
80 plus percent won by one candidate in a 10-way race in his home county. County Board of Elections violating the law and opening sealed ballot containers privately, and then basically shrugging her shoulders like, "Well, we, you know, what? So what? So what? Yeah, we did.
Well,
so what?"
It's messy, and we're in a mess because we're out of time.
Well, we're going to talk more about this stuff. Okay. We're going to talk next week. We'll talk about more about Masterpiece Cakes and the outcome of it. we want to talk about it because we'll know here because they have 10 days to file a suit. So we'll know if they filed a suit on this issue
next
and
week.
Who's going to win. But again, you can thank Pat Tiberi and I guess John Houston in some senses for the reason why we're going to continue on with questions about ballot integrity at least through this November's election.
And Pat Tiberi's reputation continues to play through. Well, that being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.